Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start today with a tariff article from Fortune Magazine and the Associated Press. Dated April 20th, the title of the article is, Starting Monday, Businesses Can Claim Refunds for Trump's Unconstitutional Tariffs, but it will take 60 to 90 days to get paid. A refund system for businesses that paid tariffs, which the U.S. Supreme Court ruled President Donald Trump imposed without the constitutional authority to do so, is scheduled to launch on Monday. Importers and their brokers will be able to begin claiming refunds through an online portal beginning at 8 a.m., according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the agency administering the system. It's the first step in a complicated process that also might eventually lead to refunds for consumers who were billed for some or all of the tariffs on products shipped to them from outside the United States. Companies must submit declarations listing the goods on which they collectively put billions of dollars toward the import taxes the court subsequently struck down. If CBP approves the claim, it will take 60 to 90 days for a refund to be issued, the agency said. The government expects to process refunds in phases, however, focusing first on more recent tariff payments. Any number of technical factors and procedural issues could delay an importer's application, so any reimbursements businesses plan to make to customers likely would trickle down slowly. In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court on February 20th found that Trump usurped Congress's tax-setting role last April when he set new import tax rates on products from almost every other country, citing the U.S. trade deficit as a national emergency that warranted his invoking of a 1977 Emergency Powers Law. Although the court majority did not address refunds in its ruling, a judge at the U.S. Court of International Trade determined last month the companies subjected to IEEPA tariffs were entitled to money back. Customs and Border Protection said in court filings that over 330,000 importers paid a total of about $166 billion on over 53 million shipments. Not all of these orders qualify for the first phase of the refund system's rollout, which is limited to calls cases in which tariffs were estimated but not finalized or within 80 days of a final accounting. To receive refunds, importers have to register for the CPB's electronic payment system. As of April 14th, 56,497 importers had completed registration and were eligible for refunds totaling $127 billion, including interest, the agency said. Megan Supino, a partner at Ice Miller, said the law firm has advised clients to carefully list in their declarations all of the document numbers for forms that went to CBP to describe imported goods and their value. If there's an entry on that file that does not qualify, it may cause the entire entry to be rejected, or that line might be rejected by Customs, she said. Supino thinks the portal going live will require composure as well as diligence. Like any electronic online program that goes live with a lot of interest, I would expect that there may be some hiccups with the program on Monday, she said. So, we continue to ask everyone to be patient, because we think that patience will pay off. Nagai Hunya, the partner in charge of transfer pricing at accounting and consulting firm Armanino, said most companies claiming refunds will have imported a mix of items, and not all will qualify right away. It's about having a clear process in place and keeping track of what's been submitted and what's been paid, so nothing falls between the cracks, she said. Each file can include thousands of entries, but accuracy is critical, as submissions can be rejected if formatting or data is incorrect. Small businesses have eagerly awaited the chance to apply for refunds. Brad Jackson, co-founder of After Action Cigars in Rochester, Minnesota, said he started compiling records and preparing to enter information into the system the moment CPB announced the launch date. The company imports cigars and accessories from Nicaragua and the Dominican Republic. Last year, it paid $34,000 in tariffs and absorbed much of the cost instead of raising customer prices, Jackson said. Last spring, he had a 2-week delay in a shipment due to a missing document, so he's now being more careful with the refund documents, he said. My main concern is the turnaround time, Jackson said. A refund process that takes several months to complete doesn't solve the cash flow problem that it is supposed to fix. Tariffs are paid by importers, and some companies pass on the tax costs to consumers via higher prices. The system starting up Monday will refund tariffs directly to the businesses that paid them, which are not obligated to share the proceeds with customers. However, class action lawsuits that aim to force companies, ranging from Costco to Ray-Ban maker Essilor Luxottica, to reimburse shoppers are winding their way through the U.S. legal system. Individuals may be more likely to receive refunds from delivery companies like FedEx and UPS, which collected tariffs on imports directly from consumers. FedEx has said it would return tariff refunds to customers when it receives them from the CPB. Supporting our customers as they navigate regulatory changes remains our top priority, FedEx said in a statement. We're working with our customers as CPB begins processing refunds and plans to begin filing claims on April 20th. And for those of you who are wondering, the Monday in question is in the article is April 20th, which is in fact last Monday, since you'll be hearing this program on April 27th. Now let's talk about inflation. This article is Eleanor Pringle. It is from Fortune magazine, dated April 20th. If the economy feels even worse for you than inflation data is showing, that might be because childcare isn't deemed a necessity. Inflation isn't in a great place right now. Despite affordability becoming the buzzword of D.C., prices are moving in the opposite direction to consumer wishes. The latest Consumer Price Index, CPI, report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows inflation jumped once again, up to 3.3% over the past 12 months. Much of this has come from increases in commodities like gasoline, which largely can be attributed to the oil supply shock following U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iran. A tentative optimist might suggest things are looking up, with the White House suggesting an end to the conflict is imminent. But that does little to address the reality for those paying higher prices at the pump, many of whom had hoped Trump's return to office would see the power of their day-to-day spending improve at best or plateau at worst. Yet even inflation of 3.3% belies the strain some households are under. Families paying for child care, for example, may find their situation feels significantly worse than economic data describes. The economy is constantly shifting, and no single household, no single consumer, is experiencing things exactly the same way, Taylor Bowley, an economist at the Bank of America Institute, told Fortune in an exclusive interview. When people look at GDP, for instance, those prints look pretty good. But then we really dive deep into some of this by income. We've also seen child care has been a topic that has been particularly prevalent for so many households. Because from an economist's standpoint, child care isn't necessarily a necessity. But for many families, it totally is. This is not a discretionary item. The gap shows up clearly in how the CPI is constructed. The Bureau of Labor Statistics assigns each category a relative importance weight based on an average household spending. As of December 2025, the combined category of tuition, school fees, and child care accounts for just 2.5 of the index, but most of that reflects college tuition, 1.35, while daycare and preschool make up just under 0.7%. That puts childcare on par in CPI terms with categories like water and sewer services, shopping club memberships, or tools and hardware, an unlikely reflection of how central it is for so many families. This isn't an error. It's a feature of the system. The CPI is designed to reflect average spending across all households, including those without children. But for families who do pay for children, those costs can take up a far larger share of their budget, meaning price increases will hit them much harder than the headline inflation data suggests. We've seen that childcare in our data has continued to rise, Boley adds. The cost of childcare obviously impacts labor force decisions, and that in turn impacts labor growth as a whole. Consumers are well aware of this fact. In 2024, Pew Research asked nearly 9,000 people why they had chosen to or did not have children. The most popular reasoning was that either these people didn't want to or it just never happened. But 12% of the respondents also said they couldn't afford to raise a child. Last year, Boley reported, U.S. child care costs were rising 1.5 times as fast as overall inflation, up 5.2% year over year in September. Regional differences are also becoming more noticeable. New England was up 6.6%, for example, and the West North Central areas surged 8.2% year over year as of September. Meanwhile, in the South, Nashville led major cities with a more than 6% increase from 2024 averages. In the October note, Boley highlighted that the share of households with more than one source of income making child care payments each month is falling every year, most prominently among lower income households. It stands to reason that paying for child care has become so expensive that parents have little choice but for one of them to leave their job. This very much disproportionately impacts women, Boley added. We've looked at how moms have traded in, to some extent, careers for children. One reason is that child care has been, at least within CPI data, and very much so also within our own data, particularly sticky. It is still rising around 1.5 times the rate of overall inflation, which is a real pain point for a lot of families. Our next article outlines a rather unique corporate strategy on the part of a well-known shoe company. The article is by Phil Wabi. It's from Fortune magazine, dated April 20th. Here's the title: From Wool Sneakers to GPUs, Allbirds' Desperate AI Pivot and 600% Stock Surge Explained. Many companies, from Walmart to United Airlines, have been heavily touting their use of artificial intelligence to get some more love from Wall Street during this AI boom, and some have successfully boosted their stock's value. Now Allbirds has joined the fray. The shoe company announced on Wednesday it would reinvent itself as an AI computing infrastructure company, despite having no history whatsoever there. Investors bit, driving shares up 600% in afternoon trading. Allbirds, maker of the once wildly popular wool sneakers, favored by the Silicon Valley Cognoscenti, announced recently that it was selling itself to a brand management company, American Exchange Group, for $39 million, about 1% of its 2021 peak market capitalization. It gave no indication at the time, however, that such a dramatic pivot was in the works. On Wednesday, the company announced that it had secured $50 million in financing to turn itself into a tech company with a long-term vision to become a fully integrated GPU as a service and AI native cloud solutions provider. and that it would change its name to Newbird AI. The company also appeared to back away from its once-touted environmental advocacy, asking shareholders to allow it to remove references to the company from being operated for the environmental conservation public benefit. It was, to put it mildly, a surprising move. Allbirds has never offered AI products or services, has zero expertise or history in the field, and has no GPO procurement teams or data center experience. So, why do it? We are in an era of intense speculative fervor around AI that has led to big run-ups in stock values at the mere mention of the term. Many commentators have compared this moment with the 27 and 2018, when a number of companies with absolutely nothing to do with cryptocurrency changed their names and saw shares jump. Remember when Long Island Iced Tea Corporation, a small beverage maker, changed its name to Long Blockchain and declared that it would leverage the benefits of blockchain technology? Its stock surged 500%, but within months, the shares were delisted from NASDAQ. Allbirds last week announced its new Canvas Cruiser collection, along with a partnership with Pantone, the color company. The company did not respond to a request for comment on whether it still planned to pursue the shoe line. Canvas is relatively new territory for a brand famous for its wool shoes, but Allbird probably has better odds of pulling off a stylistic reinvention within its market category than it will trying to be something it clearly isn't, an AI player. Here's a question for you. Have you noticed any company cutting food prices recently? The answer is there is one that's been doing it. This article's by Phil Waba, dated April 20th from Fortune magazine. Title is Food Companies Are Finally Cutting Prices. PepsiCo Shows It's Worth It. After accepting the reality that its inflation-weary customers have had enough of price increases in recent years, PepsiCo slashed U.S. prices on Lay's, Doritos, Cheetos, and Tostitos chips by up to 15% in February. It seems to have worked. The move is helping bring back some of the food and beverage makers' customers who'd gone AWOL, according to the company's latest results. The company said on Thursday that revenue had jumped 8.5% to $19.4 billion in the first quarter of 2026, compared with the same period a year earlier, noting a strong performance in its North American snacks business. The consumer is coming back multiple times to our brands, PepsiCo CEO Ramon LaGuardia said Thursday during a conference call with investors. PepsiCo's price cuts echoed those of other food companies and restaurant chains in the past year, as customers have struggled with food inflation, in some cases reversing the price hikes of the 3 years after the pandemic. Late last year, General Mills cut prices on nearly two-thirds of its grocery products in North America, helping sales by volume recover. Conagra, Kraft Heinz, and J.M. Smucker have also had to cut prices on some of their products to win back consumers. Restaurant chains, too, have had to woo back consumers weary of all the inflation of recent years. Earlier this month, McDonald's announced a budget-focused McValue menu with 10 items that each cost under $3 beginning next week. We are absolutely going to make sure that we are protecting our leadership position in value, CEO Chris Kepczynski told Wall Street analysts earlier this year. Rivals include Wendy's and Burger King, who've also been ramping up their deals. Though these cuts provide some relief, they won't get consumers back to the prices of just a few years ago. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic that sent ingredient costs way up, food companies have steadily increased prices on a range of items. The U.S. Department of Agriculture found that food prices rose a total of 23.6% between 2020 and 2024. restaurant prices have risen nearly 30% since 2020, and that restaurant inflation, while much lower now than in 2022, remains above historical averages. The recent price cuts on food and deals at restaurants suggest a shift in attitude among the CEOs and CFOs of many companies in these sectors, who were insisting only 2 or 3 years ago that customers wouldn't be deterred by rising prices. It was only in 2024 that many companies started to concede on investor calls that maybe, just maybe, they'd overdone the price hikes. Companies were under enormous pressure from Wall Street to protect profit margins during the inflation run-up. But it's risky to pass along those higher costs. Once you lose a customer who feels gouged or ripped off, it's very hard to win them back, no matter how much you spend on marketing. That kind of pain can be avoided by companies listening to customers more and to Wall Street less. Over the years, there have been many mergers in the airline industry, and here is a rumor of a particularly large one. The article's by Sean Tully. It's dated April 20th from Fortune magazine. The title is, "A United American Merger is by no means impossible, given that the president loves big deals." In the past few days, headlines are buzzing over the possibility of a mega merger that broke before the news broke would have been seemingly inconceivable, a possible tie-up between United Airlines and American Airlines. American already ranks as the world's largest carrier by passengers flown, and United stands fourth. At their current sizes, the combo would be twice the size of both second-place Delta and number three Ryanair on the global stage, and ferry over 3.5 times as many folks as continental Europe's largest stalwart, Lufthansa. In the U.S., the deal would break a near three-way tie with Delta for available seats and catapult a new behemoth into the by far the most dominant stateside position in the annals of air travel. Anytime one airline seeks to buy a rival, the proposed transaction attracts antitrust scrutiny and political controversy practically unmatched in any other realm of M&A. And because of its scale in an already highly concentrated sector and potential to raise fares, limit choice, and curb the frequency of service to dozens of smaller markets, this mother of all unions would face far fiercer than usual opposition on multiple fronts. Hence, it's a long shot. But the industry insiders Fortune interviewed swear that it is by no means impossible. The reason? The Trump administration's attraction to grand gestures. You can call it broad exercises in industrial policy that remake wide swaths of the economy and may sideline the usual top goals, such as ensuring strong competition. Here are 5 burning questions this potential mega merger raises. How did United's unusual quest come about? The week of April 13th, Reuters revealed, apparently for the first time, a White House meeting held on February 25th to discuss the over $500 million redevelopment project planned for Dulles International Airport near Washington, D.C. Reuters reported that President Trump hosted United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby at the confab. United is the dominant carrier at Dulles, claiming an 82% market share. Fortune has further learned from people familiar with the talks that Susie Wiles, the president's chief of staff, was instrumental in organizing the discussion. According to these sources, Wiles is strongly committed to the sweeping Dulles revamp that includes a new United concourse and would like to see Trump receive recognition for the new Dulles. The president won't rename Ronald Reagan Washington National for himself, quips an industry insider. Texas Governor Greg Abbott also attended, say people Fortune spoke to. Both airlines are crucial to the Lone Star State's economy. American is headquartered in Fort Worth, and United States dominates George Bush Intercontinental, in Houston. According to the Reuters piece and other accounts, Kirby floated the joining of forces concept directly to the president. Kirby contended that the combination would achieve the giant scale required to better battle international airlines that, he's noted in the past, are often heavily subsidized by their governments, handing them an unfair edge. In a September 2025 interview, Kirby observed that foreign flag carriers supply two-thirds of seats on flights headed abroad from U.S. airports, yet around 60% of the passengers are U.S. citizens. Kirby reportedly emphasized to Trump that by attracting a larger proportion of international traffic, this supercarrier would hike American competitiveness and reduce our overall trade deficit. Asked about the proposed prospect of United acquisition of American at a briefing on April 15th, Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt stated, "It's not anything that we have a position on or are commenting on. I know the idea has been proposed by private industry, but it's not something the president or the White House have an opinion on or are weighing in on at this time." Here's the second question. How does soaring fuel prices play a role in the United American merger interests? From 2005 to 2016, the U.S. airline industry endured a consolidation wave that reduced the number of major players from 9 to the current Big Four: American, United, Delta, and Southwest, the group that now controls 80% of the domestic market. In many of those deals, a jump in the price of jet fuel proved the tipping point, forcing weaker carriers into the arms of stronger rivals, including America West's takeover of U.S. Airways in 2005, Delta's acquisition of Northwest in 2008, and Southwest's purchase of Air Trans in 2011. Since the start of the Iran conflict on February 28th, the price of jet fuel has jumped from $100 a barrel to nearly $200. That spike, and especially the likelihood that after the conflict ends, costs will remain well above the pre-war level, is hitting the weaklings far harder than the thriving warriors, especially the two biggest profit makers, Delta and United. Of course, the leap triggered by the damage to oil infrastructure in the Middle East and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz happened after the White House session on Dulles International. But Americans' fragile financial state makes it highly vulnerable to any oil shock. In 2025, it earned just $111 million on $55 billion in revenues, and the interest expense on its crushing $37 billion in debt pretty much erased its operating income. By comparison, United posted $3.5 billion in profits on $59 billion in sales, numbers that give it lots of cushion to withstand all rough weather. Like Delta, United has thrived by luring premium customers, especially the business crowd that pays extra to reserve at the last minute, while American has struggled in attracting that highly lucrative tier. Once again, a leap in fuel costs. They represent between 20 and 30% of operating expenses. Promises to unleash a new wave of buying that further narrows the roster. As Delta CEO Ed Bastian said on Delta's quarter one earnings call, "Over my career, I've seen many periods of disruption in this industry, and time and again, higher fuel prices have been the most powerful catalyst for change, separating the winners and forcing weaker players to rationalize, consolidate, or be eliminated. American, the largest airline in the world, is also one of the most vulnerable to the force that more than any other has reshaped the industry." Next question, how would routes be affected if American merged with United? A deal would create a colossus potentially wielding much greater power in far more markets than any airline ever. As of today, one of the two carriers holds market shares of 44% or more in one of the nation's 50 largest airports. America's captured 44% in Phoenix, 66% in Miami, 72% in Philadelphia, and 86% in Dallas-Fort Worth, while United towers at 50% in Denver, 55% in San Francisco, and 75% in Houston. Locking arms would lift their slice of passenger pie in the New York and Chicago airports and in LAX, respectively, to 45%, 70%, and 46%. They would also rise to number one from lesser status in Honolulu, Fort Myers, West Palm Beach, Pittsburgh, and San Antonio. The rub for passengers and regulators. Airlines make the most money when they're either a monopoly carrier on a route or face just one other competitor. Mike Fitzgerald, an analyst for Cowen and Company, projects that the pro forma carrier would have no fewer than 287 of those metro-to-metro connections. What's good for United could be a downer for travelers. And, traditionally, anything that shrinks the list of rivals linking the same two metros from a longer roster to just one or two raises red flags for regulators. Next question. Let's get real. How likely is the deal to happen? The Trump approach to airline consolidation represents a sharp departure from the Biden template. The previous administration quashed JetBlue's purchase of Spirit in 2024. Spirit then went, and remains, bankrupt, and successfully sued to nix a joint venture between American and JetBlue called the Northeast Alliance. By comparison, under the Trump regime, Allegiant in mid-March gained antitrust approval for its acquisition of Sun Country after a quick review. The posture of Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy is particularly revealing. In a recent interview on CNBC, Duffy stated that he sees room for airline mergers. He also declared that the president loves big deals, suggesting that the POTUS might get a kick from greenlighting a biggie in this fabled super high-profile sphere. Still, a United purchase of American would unleash strong opposition from state attorneys general, who would fear that their residents would suffer shrunken schedules and pricier tickets. Unions might also rebel, since it's notoriously hard to integrate seniority lists for the likes of pilots and flight attendants. Most of all, even though the Trump administration favors a lighter regulatory touch, the near monopoly clout the combination would exert on so many routes might prove a no-go for the Department of Justice. But here's the roadblock that may be decisive, and it has nothing to do with the opposition of regulators, AGs, or unions. Duffy has cautioned that a major merger would require that the airlines peel off some of their assets, meaning axe gates and landing slots at airports where they hold extremely strong positions. Those requirements would clear the runways for competitors, including low-cost carriers, and ramp up the competitive heat. That's a big negative for United. The obligation to sacrifice many lucrative routes would undermine a lot of the potential benefits of the deal. The acquirer would also need to assume all of American's massive debt. Yet United wouldn't be getting full value because all of the carve-outs at airports where competition is lowest and its profits potentially the highest. Plus, past cases show that it's time-consuming and expensive to combine reservation and computer systems, as well as fleets and workforces. So big expenses come up front, and the benefits of consolidation may be minimal, considering what's peeled off. So, by conventional standards, the odds are long. On the other hand, the industry seldom seen a more daring swashbuckler than Scott Kirby. He's done it twice before, and he recognizes that if it doesn't happen under fellow wheeler-dealer Trump, it will never happen. News of Kirby's proposal to Trump at the White House was a big surprise. and United American flying under the same flag is probably a surprise too far. And the last question, is Carl Icahn waiting in the wings? Until all the speculation over United American erupted, the takeover talk centered on JetBlue. In early 2024, legendary investor Carl Icahn took a 10% stake in the airline and subsequently won two board seats. The Icahn blueprint typically revolves around buying into troubled targets on the cheap, then putting them in play. Now JetBlue has reportedly hung out a for sale sign. Media reports that the Queens-based carrier has hired advisors to pitch Alaska Airlines, Southwest, and United. At age 90, the wily Icahn knows that the chances that Kirby wins the airline bid for JetBlue look harmless by comparison, especially since the Trump administration has already shown leniency on the Allegiant takeover of Sun Country. No one's talking about Icahn and the scenario making all the noise, but when the condensation trial clears, it could be this seasoned warrior behind the scenes who helped orchestrate the next big sale, a sale that's part of still another fuel shock-driven upheaval where the weakest performers will need shelter. Who ends up with whom is a game to flummox even the greatest odds makers. Now here's a story about a change in personnel of one of the biggest companies on the planet. Apple has stated that Tim Cook will be stepping down as its CEO in September, and that a gentleman by the name of John Ternus will be taking his place. This is from Fortune magazine, dated April 21st. The title of the article is Meet John Ternus, the 51-year-old former swimming champ who will succeed Tim Cook as Apple's CEO. Apple has officially announced its most significant leadership transition in more than a decade. John Ternus, the company's 51-year-old senior vice president of hardware engineering, has been named CEO as Tim Cook's successor, effective September 1st. Cook will become executive chairman of the board, and he will remain CEO through the summer, working on the transition. It's been the greatest privilege of my life to be the CEO of Apple, and to have been trusted to lead such an extraordinary company, Cook said in a statement. I love Apple with all of my being, adding Terminus has the mind of an engineer, the soul of an innovator, and the heart to lead with integrity and honor. Industry observers and Apple insiders have long viewed Ternus as the most likely candidate to inherit the reins of one of the world's most valuable technology companies. According to a report from Bloomberg's Mark Gurman, who's reported accurately on Apple for years, thanks to sources deep within the company. The speculation intensified after Apple's chief operating officer, Jeff Williams, once considered Cook's natural successor, stepped down from the operational responsibilities in July 2025. With Williams out of contention, Gurman said that Terminus emerged as the most likely heir apparent. Ternus brings a combination of technical expertise and institutional knowledge to the succession conversation. According to his LinkedIn profile, the mechanical engineer joined Apple's product design team in 2001 and has overseen hardware engineering for virtually every major product in the company's current portfolio. His fingerprints are on every generation of iPad, the latest iPhone lineup, and AirPods. He played a crucial role in the Mac's transition to Apple Silicon. He also had a prominent role during Apple's most recent keynotes, introducing products like the new iPhone Air. He is a visionary whose contributions to Apple over 25 years are already too numerous to count, and he is without question the right person to lead Apple into the future, Cook said in a statement. Apple's public relations teams had also begun putting the spotlight on Ternus, according to Gurman, signaling the company may be preparing for a gradual transition of power. Beyond product launches, Ternus had taken on responsibilities that extended well beyond traditional hardware engineering, influencing product roadmaps, features, and strategic decisions typically reserved for more senior executives. At 51, Turnus mirrors Cook's age when he became CEO in 2011, positioning him for potentially a decade or more of leadership. This longevity factor likely appealed to Apple's board of directors, who prefer stability in leadership transitions. His engineering background also matches where Apple is going as a company, exploring emerging technologies like artificial intelligence and mixed reality. Turnus's journey to the top of Apple began at the University of Pennsylvania, where he distinguished himself both academically and athletically. He graduated in 1997 with a Bachelor of Science in Engineering, majoring in mechanical engineering. But Turnus wasn't just focused on his studies. He was a competitive swimmer who made his mark in the pool. A 1994 report in the Daily Pennsylvanian revealed Turnus's athletic prowess when he won both the 50-meter freestyle and 200-meter individual medley at the university swimming competition. More remarkably, Turnus is an all-time letter winner for the UPenn men's swimming team, representing the varsity swim team a record number of times. After graduation, Turnus joined Virtual Research Systems as a mechanical engineer. Virtual Research Systems, while not widely known today, was part of the early virtual reality wave of the 1980s and 1990s, working on VR headsets and immersive technologies. This four-year stint exposed Turnus to cutting-edge display technology and human-computer interfaces, experience that would prove invaluable during his later work on products like the Apple Vision Pro. Turnus joined Apple's product design team in 2001 at a pivotal moment in the company's history. Steve Jobs had returned, the iMac had revitalized the company, and Apple was preparing to launch products that would redefine entire industries. Starting as a relatively junior member of the product design team, Turnus initially worked on external Mac monitors. By 2013, Turnus had been promoted to Vice President of Hardware Engineering, overseeing AirPods, Mac, and iPad development. His portfolio expanded in 2020 when he took charge of iPhone Hardware Engineering, previously overseen by Dan Rizzio. When Rizzio stepped down in January 2021 to focus on the Apple Vision Pro project, Turnus was promoted to Senior Vice President of Hardware Engineering, making him a member of Apple's executive team. Turnus also earned increased visibility at product launches and industry events, becoming a regular presenter at Apple's keynote events, revealing refreshes of the iMac and MacBook Pro, introducing the 2018 iPad Pros, unveiling the iMac Pro, and presenting the completely redesigned 2019 Mac Pro. Crucially, Turnus was also responsible for unveiling Apple Silicon to the world, as well as the new iPhone Air. Turnus stands out, Gurman wrote. He's charismatic and well-regarded by Apple loyalists and trusted by Cook, who's granted Turnus more responsibilities. The executive emerged as a key decision-maker on product roadmaps, features, and strategies, extending his influence beyond the traditional scope of a hardware engineering chief. When Apple began selling the Phone 17 lineup in September 2025, it was Turnus who ushered in customers to the company's Regent Street store in London, a role Cook served at Apple's Fifth Avenue location, Gurness noted. The choice of Turnus represents Apple's preference for promoting from within rather than seeking external leadership. It also signals a shift toward prioritizing technical innovation over purely operational excellence as the company seeks to reinvigorate product categories beyond the iPhone that generates the majority of its revenue. The company's struggles with Apple Vision Pro and its efforts to compete in artificial intelligence suggest technical leadership may be exactly what Apple needs for its next chapter. Now we're going to talk about gambling. This article's from Fortune magazine. It's by Jeff John Roberts. It's dated April 20th. Kalshi's fight over sports betting is hurtling towards the Supreme Court, and the future of gambling is at stake. Prediction markets Kalshi and Polymarket claim to be truth machines that offer insights into everything from elections to interest rates. But they're also something else: massive sports betting platforms. Recent reports have found that sports wagers account for over 85% of all bets on Kalshi, and that during one four-day stretch, the platform made $25 million in fee revenue from March Madness alone. Prediction markets may have all sorts of promising applications, but for now, sports are clearly the young industry's golden goose, a goose that faces the very real possibility of being killed. The threat comes from state governments and Native American tribes, who have filed a flood of legal challenges to claim that Kalshi is running an unlicensed gambling operation. Judges in at least three states have agreed with this argument, but others have sided with Kalshi and held that its sports wagers are a unique type of contract allowed by federal law. Earlier this month, a federal appeals court ruled on the issue for the first time, siding with Kalshi over the state of New Jersey. But this week, a different set of judges heard arguments in an appeal out of Nevada and made comments that suggested that they will come to a different conclusion. If that occurs, or if another appeals court rules against Kalshi, the issue will be teed up for the Supreme Court by next year, according to gaming industry lawyers, who believe this is a likely outcome. So how might the Supreme Court rule on a sports prediction market industry expected to grow to around $200 billion in volume this year? For now, observers regard the outcome, which turns on state versus federal power, as well as how to apply a law created in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, as a true jump ball. Meanwhile, the legal scuffles have also prompted members of Congress to take sides in a fight that will decide not just the fate of the upstart prediction market industry, but the future of gambling in America. Basic abductive reasoning tells us that if it looks like gambling, talks like gambling, and calls itself gambling, it's gambling, wrote U.S. Circuit Judge Jane Roth, citing in dissent with the New Jersey Division of Gaming Enforcement in this month's ruling by the Third Circuit. Unfortunately for the New Jersey regulators, Roth was outvoted by two other appeals court judges, who pointed out that while the wagers on Kalshi might look like gambling, they are technically events contracts, which are classified as swaps under federal law. The idea of a swap is familiar enough, but the word took on a very specific meaning following the financial crisis of 2008. That's when a huge stack of credit default swaps, insurance deals between giant financial firms invisible to the broader market, imploded, triggering a meltdown across Wall Street. In response, Congress passed a series of reforms known as Dodd-Frank, which included a rule that made swaps a new form of derivative under the oversight of the Commodities Future Trading Commission. In the eyes of the Third Circuit Court majority, Kalshi had obtained a so-called designated contracts market license, fair and square, which means it has the right to operate a swaps forum where users enter wagers with each other on nearly anything, including sports. The other big question for the Third Circuit and over a dozen other courts in the country is whether Kalshi's status as a swap operator, which is a subset of futures trading, means it can blow off state gambling authorities. Those agencies enjoy so-called police powers, reserved to the states by the Constitution, and have long used that authority to oversee or ban gambling. The problem for New Jersey and other states is the concept of preemption, a doctrine that says the federal government, when lawfully exercising its powers, takes precedence over state agencies operating in the same field. Common examples are fields like immigration or farmer regulation, which have seen the feds totally preempt state authorities. The case of Kalshi is less cut and dry, but the Third Circuit at least concluded that the platform's status as a swap operator means New Jersey gambling authorities are preempted from regulating it too. The dissenting judge, however, didn't buy this premise and accused her colleagues of buying into acts of alchemy that transformed old-fashioned sports betting into futures trading. Right now, it is the industry, says Dustin Gawker, describing how much sports betting contributes to the prediction markets industry. Gawker, who publishes a newsletter devoted to the sector, believes that other categories, including wagers related to politics and crypto prices, will make up a greater share of prediction market bets over time. But for now, sports is the only game in town, pun intended, and has helped Kalshi and Polymarket justify eye-popping valuations of $22 billion and $20 billion, respectively. Needless to say, those valuations would be punctured badly if courts ultimately rule Kalshi's status as a swap operator doesn't shield it from state authorities, and there is a distinct possibility that that could happen. At a hearing before the Ninth Circuit this week, reports say judges appeared to favor the arguments of the state of Nevada over those of Kalshi, as well as Robinhood and Crypto.com, which have launched prediction markets of their own. Kalshi's main rival, Polymarket, is not part of the litigation, since for now, it is not operating in the United States. A ruling from that appeals court is expected in coming weeks, and if it goes against the prediction market companies, it will create the sort of circuit split that makes a case ripe for the Supreme Court. In the meantime, though, it is likely the top court may wait for further appeals rulings to bubble up in other courts. If you are the prediction markets, the goal is to create litigation in as many circuits as possible to expand the runway, said gaming lawyer Daniel Wallach, explaining that a prolonged legal battle will buy Kalshi and others times to keep offering sports bets. Meanwhile, the prospect of sprawling litigation on another predictions market front is already a reality. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission, long a relatively small and obscure agency, has taken the unusual step of seeking court rulings to stave off Arizona, Connecticut, and Illinois, all of which are home to significant gaming interests, from issuing injunctions against Kalshi. What matters most, of course, is how the Supreme Court might rule, and for now, lawyers say any outcome appears genuinely uncertain. This is a classic case of old tools being applied to cutting-edge technologies, and it's too soon to say how courts will come out on those questions, said Austin Evers, a partner at Freshfields in Washington, D.C. That echoes the view of other attorneys, including Kaven Sadeghi, a partner at Jenner & Block in New York. He notes that while the Trump administration and some Republicans support the prediction markets, conservative judges are frequently sympathetic to states' rights arguments, an inclination that could be at play on the heavily conservative Supreme Court. Lawyers note that Kalshi and its allies will also have to contend with a pair of relatively recent rulings by the top court that are unlikely to help their cause. The first is the 2018 ruling known as Murphy versus NCAA that struck down the federal government's exclusive authority over sports betting, which could undermine the CFTC's claim that its authority over sports-related swaps freezes out the states. The other is a case known as Loper-Bright from 2024, where the justices ruled that courts owe no deference to the expertise of agencies, which could again undercut the CFTC's position. Even if the Supreme Court were to rule against Kalshi, not a sure thing by any means, that is hardly the end of the matter. even as the litigation train barrels toward the top court, other branches of government are taking an interest in prediction markets. Pervasive gambling is not good for society. It turns life into a casino, traps people in addiction and debt, surges domestic violence, and fosters manipulation. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat, New York, wrote on X in response to news from Polymarket that it has secured a partnership with Major League Baseball. The remark is hardly a surprise, given Ocasio-Cortez's progressive reputation. What is surprising is that numerous conservatives piped up to agree with her, including Daily Wire host Michael Knowles, who wrote, "This is sad. I agree with AOC." While Republicans in Congress typically march in lockstep with President Trump, several members have already sought to corral prediction markets, including Senator John Curtis, Republican, Utah, who was co-sponsor of a bipartisan bill with Senator Adam Schiff, Democrat, California, titled the Prediction Markets Are Gambling Act. The bill proposes to close what the legislatures deem a CFTC loophole. Evers, the Freshfields lawyer, says that prediction markets are still new enough that overall public opinion has not yet coalesced about how to regulate them, and that even if Democrats take back control of Congress in the midterms, it is not automatic that legislation will follow. It's always easy placing a bet on Congress being unable to pass legislation, notes Evers. But he adds that prediction markets amount to an important new public policy debate, so lawmakers are likely to be engaged. Meanwhile, in a sign of the fluidity of opinion around prediction markets, Blanche Lincoln, a senator from Arkansas at the time, warned during the debate over Dodd-Frank in 2010 that regulated swaps should not be extended to cover wagers on the Masters or Super Bowl. Today, she is a registered lobbyist for Calgi, arguing the opposite. As the fate of sports-related prediction markets remains up in the air, there's one tool that could supply valuable insight for whether they will remain legal. Alas, there are no current events contracts on Calgi that let users bet on the company's own fate in Congress or in court. Folks, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11 a.m. Bye for now.